Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoCellaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, September 25th, 2011, and this is show number 331. Well, I'm going to give a big shout-out to Mark Dalton of the Tech Lounge podcast for yet again working a long time with me to help me solve a problem with the live show. I affectionately call Mark my pusher because he talks me into spending more and more money on my production, but I really appreciate his generosity in helping me during the wee hours of the morning in England. This week's entertainment was that somewhere between an update to Audio Hijack Pro or possibly the latest firmware update to Lion, the audio from GarageBand to the live show was really, really quiet. Not in a good, gentle, quiet kind of way, in an annoying, you can barely hear it kind of way. We spent hours on it, and after Mark fell exhaustedly into bed, I found a forum post on the Telestream site that seemed to show a different way to skin this particular cat than the way I was doing it. I'm not going to go into all the gory details, but I'm no longer using Audio Hijack Pro to pipe the sound into Wirecast. Instead, I'm using a combination of Soundflower and Soundflower Bed to pull this off. But the real trick involved raising the master volume in a hidden little gem. It's called the Audio MIDI Setup, a tool that's been native inside OS X for ages. Anyway, the audio was working really, really well in my test this morning and my test this afternoon. And of course, we've had more problems with it now that we're actually doing the live show. I have a workaround. The live show can hear my audio and they can hear GarageBand, but I can only hear GarageBand if it's coming out of the speakers, not my headphones. And the IceCast listeners can only hear me because I can't get GarageBand to pipe through it right now. So clearly I haven't solved the problem, but not for lack of trouble on Mark Dalton's part. Well, it's time for a monitor flicker update. When last we left our hero, she had been promised by Apple that they'd send her a new 27-inch Apple Cinema display to replace the flickering 24-inch one that I bought 3 years ago. Well, great news, the new monitor arrived, and in a few days testing, it has not once flickered. But I gotta tell you guys, 27 inches is insanely big. For the live show, I normally put GarageBand on the left, my script on the right, live chat in the bottom left, and a finder window of files I need for the show in the bottom right. Well, with 27 inches to play with, I can make GarageBand much wider and a bit taller so that I can see what I'm doing so much better. But here's the problem. Now my script is so far away, I can't see it. I know, first world problems, right? I guess I know you're very worried about how I'm going to deal with this terrible difficulty, and I'm sure your thoughts are with me. But I guess the lesson here about working with Apple or any other company is that persistence can pay off, and making you sure you get a trouble ticket opened to note how many times you've asked for a fix. A couple of weeks ago, I asked if those of you who hadn't done an iTunes review lately might dash over to iTunes and drop in a review. I wanted to take a moment and thank Pat Dangler, D-Dar, and Shai Yamini for writing up some really, really nice comments. You guys are the best. But remember I also said you don't even have to be nice in your reviews? Well, LLF4Nip also did a review that was very interesting. It's not quite complimentary, and this person seems to be under the impression that I shouldn't play content that is contrary to the Apple truth and the way. In particular, he/she feels that Nightwise is, and I'm quoting here, an atrocious troll. I find this fascinating because I adore the diversity of opinion he brings. Not just because he hasn't drunk the Apple Kool-Aid like yours truly. His opinion is so valuable. In fact, it's probably because he hasn't drunk the Kool-Aid that I think he's so great. In the same vein, I respect this reviewer's right to their opinion, and I'm glad they put up a review and told all of us what they like and don't like. It's actually a very balanced review. They're not completely uncomplimentary, but there's something they don't like, and they said so. Thanks very much for doing the review. If you haven't put up a review yet, I'd sure appreciate if you would. I'd love to see the NoCellaCast rise in the rankings and get a little more publicity. That would be really cool. Well, Steve Davidson is back with an installment in his search for an alternative to Eudora. I think you're going to be surprised at where he ended up.
Hello, NoCellaCast listeners. This is Steve Davidson. Way back in March on NoCellaCast 302, George from Tulsa broke the terrible news. macOS 10.7, Lion, would not include Rosetta. George went on to describe a method for identifying your PowerPC applications by using GetInfo, so you could start weaning yourself from them. I wrote to Allison and offered a streamlined method for finding your PowerPC applications using System Profiler, which she shared with you over the air. I then went on to share with her my personal dilemma making the transition, in her own words.
His second comment is that there's bad news for him. He lives or dies by Eudora. Evidently, that's a PowerPC application. He's been using it for like 15 years, and he's never found another email client that even comes close in terms of capability, functionality, or ease of use. He said that if he had to choose between Eudora and Lion, Lion would lose. There is a slight glimmer of hope. He read on Tidbits that the creators of Eudora have been working on its resurrection. Evidently, they're working on a project they call Eudora OSE for Open Source Edition. It's going to use the Thunderbird as the foundation for Eudora Workalike. He gave us the link to the open source site where they're documenting the project. He hasn't tried this out yet, but he's going to let us know how it works when it comes out.
Unfortunately, that glimmer of hope quickly faded. It seems to be a nearly dead product. It hasn't been updated in over a year, and it's based on an old version of Thunderbird, which makes it not secure. So I resigned myself to the fact that I was going to stay on Snow Leopard for the foreseeable future, because my other options looked limited. Thunderbird itself wouldn't cut it. I frequently use Thunderbird in another environment, and while it's not bad or anything, there are a lot of gaps between it and Eudora, which is the very reason people created the aforementioned Eudora OSE. Apple Mail, as it is in Snow Leopard, leaves a lot to be desired. I feel that Apple understandably sacrificed power to maintain its customary ease of use. I won't go anywhere near Microsoft Entourage after a very painful experience a few years ago. I'm a POP3 kind of guy. The Post Office Protocol version 3 is one of the protocols used by mail clients to fetch messages from the server and store them locally. I like to work that way. Maybe I'm just too old to change. So a webmail and cloud-based solution like Google Mail wasn't going to make me very happy. And while there are a lot of niche email clients out there, some of which may have the power and performance I seek, well, this is my email client we're talking about. Remember, lives or dies. And too much is at stake to take the risk. And I don't ever want to be an email orphan again. So that's where it stood. I was in no hurry to make the transition to Lion. And then Allison messed me up. In the July 24th Nocilla's cast, she raved about the great Mac Roundtable recording she had just completed and the great discussion about Lion. I was up to that point unaware of the Mac Roundtable podcast, so I gave it a listen, and I learned a lot, including the fact that I really don't want to sit out Lion simply because of one PowerPC application. I had to find an email client that wasn't going to leave me with buyer's remorse. I looked around again, and I thought I was out of luck. That was until I learned about Apple Mail on Lion. You see, Apple Mail in Lion is a significant step up from Apple Mail in Snow Leopard. Although it lacks a lot of the power of Eudora, it sounded like it might be a viable option. Not wanting to risk anything, I ran a test on my crash dummy iMac. This is my wife's old, retired machine that's really on its last legs. I copied all my Eudora content onto the crash dummy, and with the help of an indispensable bit of freeware called Eudora Mailbox Cleaner, the link will be in the show notes, I migrated nearly 2 decades worth of email that was carefully organized into folders and subfolders and subfolders to Apple Mail. I also used Eudora Mailbox Cleaner to migrate my filters and address book. I found that the email content all migrated very well. No messages were lost, and the folder message hierarchy remained intact. The only hiccup was that attachments lost their association, which is not surprising given the bad way Apple Mail manages attachments and the good way Eudora does. The filters migrated okay too, though some of the differences between the two email clients were evident, and some cleanup was necessary. Once I was sure Apple Mail was working, I installed Lion on the crash dummy Mac and began testing the new Apple Mail client. There were still quite a few features missing. I don't like the way attachments are handled. The method of grouping message threads is cute visually, but awkward to manipulate. Scheduled sends is a missing feature, although I suppose there may be a clumsy automator solution for that gap. And, well, I could go on. At least Apple Mail and Lion does most of what I need, and there was virtually no chance that it would be orphaned by Apple. So since mid-August, I've been running Lion on my MacBook Pro and migrated the rest of my family to Lion. And we're all pretty happy with the upgrade, limitations of Apple Mail notwithstanding. I've really enjoyed experimenting with some of Lion's new features and capabilities, including File Vault 2, and I'll save those musings for another time.
Well, Steve, I'm so glad you found a path out of your Eudoria euphoria. That's fantastic. Anyway, I'm glad to hear that Apple actually came through for you. Now, I haven't used it myself, but Dave Hamilton swears by a tool called Mail Acton from indev.ca for increasing the power of Apple Mail. I never seem to find any of those things compelling for what I needed, but perhaps it'll help you find some new ways to enhance your mail. Thanks for letting us know how this all turned out. This week, I was helping someone who came across one of my ScreenSteps tutorials online. She had some unrelated problems, but also happened to notice a small typo in what I'd written. I couldn't resist telling her how easy it would be for me to fix it. I pop open ScreenSteps, edit the text, hit publish to my website again. Basically, about a 1.5 minute effort on my part to fix it. But the best part was when she said, "I've had professional documentation people working for me in the past, and I know how hard this is to do well, and you've done a terrific job with this." So, ScreenSteps makes you look like a professional, makes other people think you're working really hard when you're secretly having fun and enjoying yourself. As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, I've been having big problems with my audio for the live show and spent hours with Mark Dalton helping me to diagnose it. When I did finally crack the code, or as I thought crack the code, the first thing I did was open ScreenSteps and grab screenshots of each of the windows and menus where I'd fiddled with things. I went to sleep knowing that it was safe for the next day. Then today, I went back and opened up ScreenSteps, dragged the steps into the right order, annotated the images with boxes, arrows, text, and even sequence numbers. Then I wrote myself some careful instructions for the why of each step. I printed it to PDF, emailed a copy to Mark for safekeeping, and now when I run into problems again, which I will, I'll be able to fix them quickly. I use ScreenSteps at least half the time just to remember stuff for myself. Blue Mango Learning have also got a public beta going on for their newest product called Clarify. Clarify serves a different need. It's more for grabbing a few quick screenshots, maybe a little of annotation, and then sending a link to someone to show them what you're talking about to clarify your point. Not to write documentation like what I do, but just to clarify something you're trying to say. Greg DeVore of Blue Mango Learning sent me an email from Donald Stein that I really like. Here's what Donald wrote to them. "Clarify for the Mac. I love it. I'm a licensed user of ScreenSteps. At first, I thought I did not need Clarify because I have ScreenSteps. But after using Clarify for a couple of weeks, I now know it supplements ScreenSteps. You really need both. By the way, I first heard about Clarify on the NoSilicast podcast with Allison Sheridan. Thanks. Can't wait for the final release of Clarify." Well, all right. With that kind of testimonial, I hope you'll run over to Blue Mango Learning and download the free trial of ScreenSteps and the public beta of Clarify and play with them both. When you do inevitably buy them, please do like lovely Don did and let them know that you heard about it on the NoSilicast. My buddy Ron has been on the hunt for a good way to use his iPad to connect to his Mac at home, and he got me intrigued with the idea as well. I'm also interested because Honda Bob has been on a quest for a way to control his home computer when he's on vacation in Louisiana. He is such a geek. Anyway, I found an application called TeamViewer that looks pretty good. The great news is that it works on the Mac and iPad, but also on the iPhone, Android, Linux, and Windows. Now we're really talking. Let's see what it can do. TeamViewer is a commercial application for businesses, but for personal, non-commercial use, it is absolutely free. Let's think about what our requirements would be for an application like this. You'd want it to be easy to connect, easy to configure, and most importantly, you'd need to be able to actually manipulate things on screen with your fingers. Being able to type, click, and right-click are critical as well. Let's get started and see how TeamViewer meets those requirements or doesn't. First part's easy. Download TeamViewer on your computer from teamviewer.com and the iPad or iPhone app from the iTunes App Store. The iPad version even has the HD in the title, so you know that's got to be good. I put links to the TeamViewer website for all of these different options. Launch TeamViewer on the Mac first, and you come to a screen showing an ID number and a password. Well, I launched it on the iPad, and for some weird reason, it came up in portrait mode, which worried me at first. The window showed a field to type in a TeamViewer ID and password. Oh, I see where they're going. It's the same one that's on the Mac. So I typed in the two numbers, and suddenly I'm watching my Mac on the iPad. That's it. Now, my fears about portrait mode were unfounded. I was able to flip it right into landscape. It's just during the login screen that it's in portrait mode. The first time you log into another computer, TeamViewer shows you the instructions to manipulate things on screen. Some of the other apps that Ron has worked with were missing at least some functionality, but TeamViewer seemed to have everything I could think of. One finger drags the mouse around. Single finger taps are like mouse clicks. To right click, use a two finger tap, or you can actually use the little mouse that's on screen at the bottom. One of the harder things to manipulate normally is to move windows around. To do it on TeamViewer, you double tap and hold. Worked like a champ. You can even manipulate scroll bars, but it's a little bit tricky. TeamViewer supports pinch to zoom, which is important sometimes because the screen on that iPad is so small, it would be even more important if you were trying to do this with a smartphone. You better have that pinch to zoom. I think my favorite gesture, though, is how you switch to a different monitor on your Mac. You actually shake the iPad. How hilarious is that? You just picture the developer sitting around going, hey, let's make it where you have to shake the iPad to switch monitors. I love stuff like that. All of the gestures worked as advertised, but I found it a little bit unintuitive that you actually had to drag the cursor arrow to where you wanted to do something. The arrow doesn't land wherever you tap like it does when you're normally using an iPad. You have to actually go get it and drag to that spot. I kept trying to double tap and drag on top of a window, but it wouldn't work because my cursor wasn't actually there yet because it was in a different part of the screen. I had to go get it. Definitely something you can get used to, but it threw me for a loop at first. To type on the iPad, position your cursor where you really want to type, tap, and then tap the keyboard at the bottom bar, and you can start typing. The one thing that was really weird for me is that I found out I've really gotten used to the predictive and corrective text on the iPad. So when I was using the iPad to type, but it was really controlling the Mac, it confused me that the Mac wasn't just correcting everything I type the same way it does on the iPad. I know the Mac has a certain amount of that, but it really is forgiving on the iPad. When you have the keyboard viewable, up across the top, you've actually got more characters you can use, like Command, Escape, Alt, and Control, along with an indent and outdent button and a full-function keyboard, including things like Print, Scroll, Lock, Copy, Paste, Page Up, Page Down, and even the ever-useful arrow keys. That rocks. In fact, why aren't we allowed to have access to those on the regular iPad keyboard anyway? There's a lot of times I want some of those, especially the arrows. In any case, I wouldn't want to write the next American novel on TeamViewer, but it's definitely usable. If you're John F. Braun, you can have logging turned on and even view your log file and connection log. There's a barrel of fun right there. There was one button on screen that mystified me, and I never figured out how to use it. It was a magnifying glass. Since TeamViewer supports pinch to zoom, why would you need a magnifying glass? If you tap it, it changes to a minus sign from a plus sign as though it would zoom out, but nothing ever changed on screen. I have no clue what it's for. This application would be great for helping out family members with their computers. All they'd need to do is launch the TeamViewer application and you're in business. The only problem you'd have is to get them to read you the password, or so I thought. I read up a little bit in the preferences and you can predefine the password and save it. Then on the remote device, you can create what are called partners. Partners are machines whose TeamViewer ID and password you want to remember. So now when I launch TeamViewer on the iPad, I click on my partner list and there's the MacBook Pro listed. Click on it and it auto logs in. For security reasons, I presume, the MacBook Pro has to be actually running TeamViewer so it wouldn't sit open all the time. In the same menu area before you log into a computer, you also see a menu for files. Click on that and you have remote access to all of the files on your computer. That was an unexpected benefit. TeamViewer shows you the root directory with a slash and a documents folder. Evidently, this must be a Windows or Linux thing because the slash got an error for me, but the documents folder actually took me to my home folder on my Mac. I navigated to a folder, tapped on a file, I could have tapped on more than one, and a menu option at the bottom said copy to my iPad. I tapped it and it asked where I wanted to drop it. I could actually create file folders from there. Yay! The file zoomed from my Mac to my iPad. Now I was on the same high-speed broadband network, so I guess that's why it was so fast. Performance while I was on this high-speed network was tolerable. Not great, a little bit laggy, but definitely livable. I tried turning off Wi-Fi, and with the crappy AT&T coverage I get in my house, one bar if I round up, the performance was pretty unlivable. If you had to manipulate your computer in an emergency, you'd use it, but it would have to be a big emergency. I'm assuming that in good 3G coverage, it wouldn't be all that bad. The only other caution I'd give on using this is that TeamViewer, you got to not let the iPad go to sleep. If it does, you have to reconnect to your computer. It's not that big a deal, and I suppose it makes sense. Just something to keep in mind. Like I said at the beginning, TeamViewer is free for personal, non-commercial use. If you're running a business, they have three levels of plans, the lowest of which is $749 plus $139 per machine after the first one. It sounds like a lot when you think about it out of your own checkbook, but for a business, that's not that much money. They do have fancier plans than that, and they also have support in a whole slew of countries. Bottom line, I found TeamViewer a big surprise hit. Free for personal use, supports file transfer, has gestures to support all mouse functions, full keyboard with advanced keys, and did I mention it's free for non-commercial use? Check it out at TeamViewer.com.
I'm sorry, but you cannot have my Mac computers there.
Albert, you come back again.
No, please.
Oh,
no.
Albert.
Oh, my God, I'm trapped in the basement by my wife, Elsa. I better contact Allison Sheridan, the very best podcaster in the world. Maybe she can help me out.
Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias.
Beep!
Hello, Allison. This is Professor Albert. I am currently trapped in my basement by my wife, Elsa. She wants to take my Mac computers, but I have them here so they're safe and sound. But I'm never going to be able to get out of here unless you can help me out. I need your smarts, Allison. Oh, be quiet, Bernard, be quiet. A couple of weeks ago, you helped me out with my new Mac Mini with my 5400 RPM hard drive, 8 gigabytes of RAM that I got from OWC very, very cheap, and a new Lion operating system. I was playing with the new features of Lion, the full screen apps, mission control, the new mail and more, flicking from screen to screen with my magic trackpad, having a very fun Mac time there. Elsa happened to be looking over my shoulder.
I want that.
She said, what do you want, my dear?
I want that, the way you make it slide around there. Please, put that on my 2005 Anna computer.
Dear, I would love to, my dear, but your 2000 iMac computer, like the one that our little dog Bernard ate, does not work with the new Lion operating system. The 2005 iMac is a power PC computer. We need an Intel computer to make it work.
Albert, I want that.
If you want, I will buy you a brand new iMac computer, which comes installed with Lion.
I am not spending $1,000 on a new computer there. I want that, and I want that on my old 2000 iMac.
Elsa, please, please.
If I don't get my old iMac with that Lion operating system, I am taking all of your computers so you can't do Lion either.
Elsa, please.
Give me that new Mac Mini. Give me your MacBook Air.
Oh, no, Elsa, please. No, please put down that rolling pin.
Give me your computers now, Arnold. You don't have to have all the fun.
Oh, no, please. So now I have locked myself in the basement with my Macs. Bernard, and Elsa is standing guard upstairs.
Albert, you get up here right now.
Oh, Allison Sheridan, help me out with this dumb question. Is there a way to upgrade a PowerPC Mac to be an Intel Mac? Could I change the motherboard there or the hard drive or something so that the old PowerPC iMac, so that it could run the Lion operating system on it? Is there a way to do that? And if there's no way to do that, is there a way to connect a used cheap Intel Mac Mini to the old iMac monitor screen so that it looks and works like an Intel iMac? Help me out, Allison. You're so smart.
Well, Professor, I gotta tell you, me and the other girls in the live chat, we're pretty much on Elsa's side here. How come you get all the new toys? Oh, wait. She's the one who doesn't want to spend the money, like $1,000 on a new computer. All right, the first thing to know is that no, you can't upgrade a PowerPC computer into an Intel Mac. You can't do it. Now, you do bring up an interesting question about using the old iMac screen as a monitor from an Intel Mac Mini. Now, here's the irony. If you had a newer iMac with a DisplayPort in it, you could pluck the Mac Mini into it via a male-to-male mini DisplayPort cable, and the iMac could be able to use it as a monitor. But if you had a newer iMac, why would you need to be the monitor for a Mac Mini? Because you could put Lion on it. Well, I have another idea. It might not be a great one, but it is an idea. Remember the whole plot line about using VNC to log into the Mac that Bernard ate? And how we went through all the different options for screen sharing? Well, what if you put a Mac Mini running Lion on the network, and then she did screen sharing from the Mac Mini to the iMac? That way, she'd have this big, beautiful machine with a great screen, the power of a new Mac Mini, but get to run Lion. I'm not sure the performance will be really good, but perhaps it could be both hardwired on Ethernet, so it could be better. At the very least, she'd be able to learn how to use Lion, not spend the money for now, and you'd be let out of the basement. Hey, Elsa, you know what? You could actually use screen sharing to get Albert's machine in the basement. You could get to it to test it without even letting him upstairs first. Try that, Elsa. Jan Zerober joins us this week with an interesting solution to a problem a lot of us have.
Let's presume you're an experienced Mac geek who's using TextExpander and has created lots of snippets on his home machine. Now you're going to your workplace and your employer has two disadvantages. Number one, the infrastructure is based on PC environment. Number two, you don't have the permission to install software on your PC, so you don't have any admin rights to your machine. This means your productivity drops and you're always cranky since you could be so much faster at your personal machine. But there's a solution to your problem. TextExpander has a PC equivalent named Breeby. Breeby acts like TextExpander, also unfortunately it doesn't look like TextExpander at all. That serves as a solution to disadvantage number one. But how about number two? Well, number two can be solved like this. Breeby's little sister is called Breeby Portable, and it runs from a USB stick, flash drive, and also from a desktop folder. And it can be installed without any admin rights, since it doesn't dig into the Windows system. And it comes even better. Breeby Portable, like Breeby itself, can use TextExpander snippets. That means you can import your homebrew and TextExpander snippets into Breeby and Breeby Portable, use them there, and even re-import them back into TextExpander in case you've created some snippets on Breeby itself. And in case you're allowed to do so, you can even sync those snippets via Dropbox between both softwares. Breeby costs only $35 and is worth every penny. So tell me, isn't that a solution to your problems?
Well, Jans, I can't believe I hadn't heard of Breeby Portable. I'm a huge fan of Breeby, using it on Windows constantly, but somehow this USB version got past me. Breeby and Breeby Portable can be found at 16software.com. If you live in a Windows world, either by choice or by servitude, Breeby should definitely be in your toolbox. Today I was working away on the show notes for this show, and Steve walked by and asked, "What's that little bloop noise I keep hearing?" I told him that lovely noise is the sound of efficiency. Every time he hears that noise, that's characters I'm not typing because TextExpander from Smile is doing the work for me. He noticed that it happens constantly. And that's because I have so many snippets, I'm super fast because of it. Now, my good friend Slough told me that the blind can jump to each new topic on my blog easier if I put a header tag on the subjects instead of just making them bold. Header tags are an HTML thing you can use. Well, boom, TextExpander has built-in header tags. So a simple comma H3 and my header tag for the heading 3 are there, with a cursor waiting patiently for me to type in the subject right between them. Every time I insert an image into the show notes, I transfer it to my website using Transmit. Then I pop open the image in Feeder and type PFF in a semicolon, which plops in this really long URL I use as the link to my images. It changes each week to have the latest date, but luckily TextExpander has built into it Edit Most Recently Expanded Snippet. That speeds me up tremendously. I gotta tell you, if you have all the time in the world and you like to have repetitive stress from typing a lot, then don't bother getting TextExpander. It is totally not for you. But if you're a lazy typer like me and you love to just go faster and faster and more efficiently every day, you can't be close to efficient without using TextExpander. Head on over to smilesoftware.com and give their free trial a spin. All you have to lose is excessive keystrokes, right? Well, be sure to tell them you heard about it here on the NoSilicast. Well, I thought the show was getting too long, but the live chat room took a vote here and decided that we should play Rod Simmons' next review from the SMR podcast. And I love his reviews, too. And who's to argue with the live chat room? I mean, those guys are in charge, right? Except for the ones that say death to Mipples. Anyway, here we go.
Hey guys, Rod Simmons from the Simple Mobile Review Podcast. This week, I'm back to review an app called Silent Film Director. But first, what is the problem that we're solving with this? You send videos to friends or to family members of either you doing something silly, friends doing something silly, or maybe the kids doing something silly. Now, every video kind of looks the same. It's beautiful quality, sometimes a little distance away because you're shooting it on a smartphone, but nonetheless, it's beautiful quality video. Why don't you make your video slightly different? Why don't you shoot a video and send it to them in black and white? Or give them the nostalgic feel of a 1920s type video? That's where Silent Film Director comes in. You can add a variety of different effects to your video. So you can have a 1920s effect, a 60s effect, 70s effects, black and white, a vintage type look to your video. But for me, probably the most fun part is that you get to add these funny little sound effects to your video. You'll probably recognize this one. So there's a wide variety of music you can actually add to your videos from what you've just heard, or like an old-timey type. It's a really fun app, so you can create your videos and make them a bit more unique and sort of stand out-ish. Now, as I said, once you grab a video that you want, you can load a video from your current library that you've already shot before. Or you can actually take the video from right inside the app. So if you've done videos historically where maybe you have a kid who's playing soccer or football and they emerge from the pack and they start running down the field, if you got that whole thing on video, you can actually take that video and run it through this process and it'll convert it. Or you can go into the app, tap the record button, and actually record a video and work with it from that perspective. Once you're done grabbing one of the videos you want, so I can navigate through here, grab one of my videos. And then once you choose your video and kind of crop around like the entire part of the video you want, it just goes through a loading aspect on the video and it starts sort of like kind of compressing down so it can actually give you your time lapse. Once your video is done, you can actually do some sharing with your video. So maybe you want to upload your video for others to see through the Silent Film Director app. You can absolutely do that. Or you could share your video through other means like YouTube or Facebook. So there's a variety of ways you can do that, either submitting to their contest or uploading to friends or even emailing the video, just saving it out to the camera roll. It's a very fun app. I've had a ton of fun with this app with my kids and doing videos. And every once in a while, I'll get them to dress up in what would look like 40s type clothes or 50s clothes or 60s clothes. And then we'll shoot a little film around the house. They like it because it gives them the ability to just be absolutely creative and do something absolutely funny. And we have fun. I should also mention that when you're shooting the video, you can actually change the speed effect. So you can either take a video and slow it down. So let's say, for example, you have a kid who's jumping off a diving board going into water and you want to slow down that effect, or if you have a kid who's breaking like for a 99 yard run and you want to speed that up a little bit, you can make it go three times the speed, so you get those kind of abnormal effects. Also, and probably the most important part, just like any 20s movie where you would get lint that was on the film or where the film didn't look actually perfect, so you kind of got those flicky lines as, you know, you went from film, like little negative piece to negative piece, you actually get that effect when you do your videos. Again, it's a free app, Silent Film Director. Now, last little plug for the podcast, Simple Mobile Review. Come on over and give it a listen. Allison listens all the time. I think she likes the show. She's actually sent in a comment for this week. It was fun responding, you know, as we sort of debated and talked around the topic. And I got another hey-tell message from Allison saying, you guys are so wrong. But come in and join in the fun. We have a blast over there. And we would love to get some audio reviews from other podcasters, as well as some listeners of the No Silicast. You guys take care and make sure you download Silent Film Director.
Rod is absolutely right. I do love the Simple Mobile Review podcast. When I wrote my iTunes review, I described the show as being like a bunch of guys arguing about football. You know, each one of them has their favorite team, and maybe one guy's team isn't doing so well, but he's still really loyal and rabid in support of it. Well, now take out football and swap in mobile devices, and that's what the Simple Mobile Review podcast is. They argue and debate, all with respect, but with the fun camaraderie of a bunch of guys who really know each other and have been together for a long time. I think the sign of a good show is when you're loving it,
But then find yourself yelling at your iPod because suddenly, in one instance, they're suddenly so wrong you need to call in and tell them. I had a lot of fun making the recording for them, and we're planning to get me on the show soon so I can argue in person. I can't wait. It's going to be a blast. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond. And this week I have a very, very new guest, someone I've actually never met before, but I was so intrigued with the work that he's doing that I tricked him into coming onto the show. I would like to introduce you to Jim Grime, also known as Singing Banana.
Hi, everyone.
Jim is the Enigma Project Officer at Cambridge University. I read his bio. It said he's rabid about maths. He's a juggler. And as his project officer page says, his ultimate purpose in life may be to simply make a fool of himself. I really like that opening. I figured you were perfect for the show.
Oh, is that how it's going to go, is it? So making a fool of myself in public makes me the ideal candidate for your podcast.
Yes. I think it's actually a requirement.
Now I understand.
So let's start off at the beginning. You work for the Enigma Project, which is associated with Cambridge University. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. Because I will tell you about that at length, if you let me.
Absolutely.
It's a wonderful thing. So this is my day job. And what Cambridge University asked me to do is I tour the UK, the United Kingdom, and the world even. I go all over the world, and I give public talks about, code breaking. So secrets and spies and espionage and the mathematics and the history of code breaking. And in particular, I show off a genuine World War II Enigma machine. And people may have heard of the Enigma machine before. It's one of the most famous cipher machines of all time. It was what Nazi Germany were using in World War II to send their secret messages to each other. So what I have is a genuine Enigma machine. It's 75 years old.
Oh, wow.
It was actually used in World War II. There aren't many of these about anymore. There are a few about in museums, but there aren't many about. Partly because they are secret machines. So when they're old or broken, you don't just put them away. You actually smash them up. So very few of these left around. And I am privileged and honored to show it off. The idea is to inspire people. It's one of the most exciting and interesting and exotic uses of mathematics.
So is it actually functioning still?
It is. Yeah, it is. It still works. And I, as I know, because it may even get more use now than it ever did, because I tour around with it almost daily. I give talks and show it off to all sorts of people, from little children, who I absolutely love, and the kids love it. The little children I absolutely adore, all the way up to not so little children, and the general public as well.
So I've been a big believer in getting kids excited about math and science. One of the things my kids get angry at me for is if a child comes to the door selling candy, I always ask them, what's your favorite subject in school? And if they say PE or I hate school, they don't get anything. If they say social studies or English, I buy one bar. And if they say math or science, I buy two bars. And my kids get, and I tell them why. And my kids get mad. And I say, well, I'm just getting ready for real life, you know.
I like that.
I'm kind of an elitist about
that over here.
Absolutely. And also getting to them when they're young enough to absorb the idea that it's exciting and fun, even though they might not remember exactly what you taught them, I think it's so easy to do.
Yeah. In fact, really, I mean, the only aim I have is to put a little idea in the back of their head. I mean, even just in the back of their head, and then just leave it there when I talk to kids, and then I just walk away. When they're little, yeah, everything's new and exciting to them, and the absolute pleasure. Of course, everyone loves it.
Yeah.
It's not a hard sell for me. It's not a hard sell. Secrets, spies, and this marvelous and this wonderful prop that I have to show off.
I had my daughter was in second grade, and she had a friend over, and I overheard the little girl say, "Math is hard." No, it was worse than that. She said, "I hate algebra." And I said, "What do you mean you hate algebra? Do you know what algebra is?" She goes, "No, but it's hard." And so she's having a sleepover, and I sat them down, and I started doing little problems with them. And I said, "Okay, you got, 1 plus something equals 2. What's something?" And they said, "Well, 1. 1 plus 1 is 2. Everybody knows that." And they said, "Give us another one." And I just started doing this. And for over an hour, they sat there and I gave them more and more complex problems. And I mean, they were doing, 2x plus 3 equals whatever and that sort of thing. And they loved it. And I'm positive neither one of them remembered exactly what I taught them, but just that they had in their head that it was fun. And that's all that had to happen.
Exactly. So, and that's exactly what I want to do. I go in, I have a nice day when I am working with kids, I have a nice day with them. We do some silly stuff. We play with codes. And the best I can hope for is to go, "Oh, that was all right. I enjoyed that." And they'll go away and have a slightly more positive feeling for maths, as they should.
Right. It can be such a fun time. So how does the Enigma machine actually work? I don't know anything much about it.
Okay, so first of all, I'll try and describe what it looks like. It's about the size of an old typewriter, right? So imagine a proper, typewriter that mm-hmm. they used to have. So imagine that, pretty much what it looks like. So you've got a keyboard, and instead of paper, it doesn't have paper. It has a second set of letters. And this second set of letters light up. So instead of printing, if you're typing in "hello," and it was exactly, instead of printing out a code, which you might expect it to do, it actually lights up the code instead, which is quite a pretty thing to look at. So these letters start to light up. Disadvantage of that, strange way to do it, but disadvantage of that is you have to have a piece of paper there and you have to be writing it down as it lights up. So essentially that's what it looks like. Inside, imagine lots of crisscross wires. So it's all kind of mixed up like spaghetti inside, full of wires, all mixed up. But what it does, essentially, as brilliant as this machine was, all it does, it's a bulb and a switch. It's a bulb and a switch and a battery. It's the most simple circuit you can make. When I press a key, it just lights up a bulb. The battery connects to a bulb and it lights up. And that's it.
Is it always the same light bulb lights up when the same key gets hit?
And this is the trick. This is the trick. What makes it different is the wires move. They have moving parts. So when you press a letter, they turn. They go click, 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 click. They turn one place clockwise. They go click, click. And when the wires physically move, it connects the battery to a different bulb.
Oh, okay.
And that's all it is.
So on the other end... Now I've typed in my message. It's lit up the lights, and I've written down what lights light up. Now I send it to my buddy in the other area with the second Enigma machine. How does they reverse that?
Exactly. So they have the second Enigma machine. So they have to now decode the message. Now their machine has to be set exactly the same
to the right rotation, right?
Exactly. All the positions have to be all the same, and there are wires that you can change. There are parts that you can change, and all the parts have to be exactly the same as the first machine. And the way that you can do that, it was written down for you on a piece of paper. You'd have all the settings written down for you. It's actually a big sheet, a big code sheet, a monthly sheet of paper with the setting for each day, each day of the month. Now, so the setting changed every day. Now, nice story is, these sheets, the Navy, the U-boats, the submarines, they would write these sheets in soluble ink, which means if you get sunk, if you get torpedoed, if you get sunk, if that book gets wet, the ink will wash away, which is how they keep the secret of the code book. So now you set your second machine, you set it exactly the same as your instructions tell you. Type in the code into the Enigma machine, and now the letters that light up won't be code. It would actually be the original message. You get the original message back. So if I type in "hello" and I get a code and it's ZXQWL, You type that into your second Enigma machine, hello will light up. It'll come back. You get the original message back.
Oh, okay. Okay. So,
very clever machine. It was a code and decode machine. The fact that it could do both was what made it one of the best machines around at the time.
So did the Allies did crack the code, though?
And that's right, exactly. So if the Allies can break this code, we all know these secret German plans, which is what we want. And so we were trying to break the Enigma code, and that's what we did. In fact, it was the Polish who broke it first, who actually broke it before World War II started.
Oh, you're kidding.
They already knew Germany was a threat. They were already starting to try to break their Enigma code. And they did. They succeeded. They had already broken it. I think in quite early, actually, 1932. And so they could already read these messages. 2 weeks before Poland was invaded, they passed on their information to the British, who then continued the work.
Wow.
And improved it and did other things as well.
That's amazing. So did the Allies pass the code around and that helped in cracking the war? Yeah. But if it was beforehand,
well, when you say pass it around, I mean you have to be careful. This is a secret service.
Sure,
secret service. The clue's in the name. I mean, they were so secretive people. So they would share. Now, Russia was our ally at the time, so they would share information, but not exactly how we broke it.
Oh,
we
okay.
Weren't sure that. They would share necessary information. We shared more with the Americans, which was the start of the special relationship that the UK have. Because secret services do not collaborate. Different countries do not collaborate in that way. World War II was the first time that America and the UK were collaborating and pooling their resources, and that's the start of the relationship UK and the USA have now.
That's fascinating. I love this kind of stuff. Do you follow current day cryptography as well?
I'm the sort of mathematics I do is very similar to the mathematics of cryptography, although I'm not a code breaker myself. So I know a bit about modern day code breaking, and I can answer questions, but I hesitate to say I'm an expert.
Well, of course not. Well, so where did you get your enthusiasm for math and physics? Where did this? I mean, one of the things that's so infectious about watching your videos, and we're going to talk about those in a minute, is that it's clear that you just absolutely adore this topic, and that's what makes them so fun to watch.
Well, I can tell you, I when I was a very small boy, going at 8 or something, I had a little toy. It was called The Little Professor, and it was by Texas Instruments of the calculator fame. And it was, I think it was a hand-me-down from my older sister. I think it actually came out around about 1979. And it had a LED display, you know, like the old digital watches with the red lights.
Right.
So it had one of those displays, and it would set you little maths problems, addition, multiplication, division, and subtraction problems. And I'd be playing around with that. And I'm sure when I was very young, I was doing level 4. Level 4 meant doing 23 times 309 in your head. I could do this. Right. So I blame that entirely. I've got it. I still have it.
Oh, do you really? Oh, that's nice.
Have it. I'm going to put it in a glass box one day in my office and say, that's it. That's
what started it all.
I actually saw this machine, this little professor, in the Science Museum in London.
Mm.
So there you go. That makes you feel old. it's now a museum piece. It's in the Science Museum in London. It's also in the Science Museum in Cambridge. I'm quite looking forward to it. Actually, someone suggested, because they've heard me tell this story, someone suggested that I should go over there and do a video and tell that story and have this. I can bring mine along at the same time.
They'd probably love that.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I hope to do that.
Right, right.
So I blame this. But then how did I, you know, but you see, that was one thing. But where I started off from, I don't come from a family of academics. Oh, they're not scientists, they're not academics. The school I went to was the local school round the corner. It wasn't a very good school, to be honest. And what inspired me was TV, science programming on TV.
Oh, really?
I learned everything I know through the television. And and that's a huge thing to me. It's an important thing to me. I don't know if it's the same in the USA, but in the UK, you have children's programs. Some of them are science programs, you know, guns and things that go bang, you know, to excite
worse yet, Barbie stuff for little girls.
Have you heard the Barbie? Have you heard of the Barbie that when you with the drawstring that they had? I think it was in the '90s. You pulled the drawstring, it talked, and it said, "Maths is hard."
Oh, you know, what's even sadder than knowing about that is I know the woman who designed it. She was a toy designer for Mattel, and she went off on maternity leave, and they added that after she designed it. She was livid. She was just – she has even worse stories of things they did to her designs while she was gone. Some other very embarrassing things happened to the ones that she designed, but she was just horrified when she heard that.
Oh, that's brilliant. Yeah, that's just amazing, that toy. And I guess the tech community, I'm avoiding saying geek, I'm avoiding saying nerd, the tech community got their own back, because Barbie had like a poll of, you know, what profession should Barbie be next?
Oh.
And computer scientist won. You shouldn't put polls like that on the internet. So they made a Barbie computer scientist.
Oh, I love it.
And she was still a very glamorous
computer scientist.
Did the best. She had
as most mathematicians and computer scientists are, quite glamorous, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, what's the difference? She had glasses, which maybe you could say, well, does she have to have glasses? I mean, is that necessary? But they gave her glasses. They were nice glasses.
Statistically speaking, probably yes.
I think they may have been green, which would be preferable to pink. If they're pink, then that may be not so good. She had a binary T-shirt. And I think in binary it said hello.
Oh, no, that's awesome.
Which was quite nice, actually. Quite nice T-shirt. So, yeah, that's all right. And I think she had a little laptop briefcase thing. She had a laptop. She had like a little, notebook. It was all right. It could have been worse.
That's wonderful.
Much more positive.
I love stuff like this. I love that the we won't call them geek community actually caused that. That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's really good. And we kind of got distracted. And
yeah, what was the topic again?
I was saying everything I learned I got from TV. So in the UK we had a presenter called Johnny Ball, who was very excitable about mathematics, used to jump up and down, very excited about it. And that's a good sort of role model of, you know, someone who's really excited. We also have something, a marvellous thing, and we're lucky to have it, called the Royal Institution Christmas Lectures. Christmas week, every year, Christmas week, we have these broadcast on television, these science lectures for children.
Hmm.
And they're presented by, and it's an honour to be asked to present this, and they're presented by, you know, a leading scientist, but, you know, a research scientist, but also a communicator, someone who can do this for children as well. So it's a very particular sort of person they want. And what a marvellous thing to be televised Christmas week. An hour lecture every day, 5 days, for the young. I'm still avoiding the word geek.
Oh, you can call us geeks. We like it. We now embrace it and consider it a compliment.
For the young, brainy kids, what a marvelous thing to have.
Oh, that is really, really neat.
I was really honored.
So you got to speak on that?
Well, not on those lectures, but hey, you know, it's always an ambition. No, a couple of months ago, I got to speak in the room that they televised those broadcasts from, the lecture theatre that's televised from, called the 5-day lecture theatre. It's actually the lecture theatre that has been there for 150 years that Michael Faraday lectured in.
Oh, wow.
It's Christmas lectures himself in, was it 1823 or something? Michael Faraday, famous for his experiments in electricity, electromagnetism.
So
I spoke in the same room. That's an honor for me.
Oh, right, right. Oh, that's, you know, you guys have so much history there. My one of my Belgian friends, Nightwise, kidded us a lot when we were in Belgium visiting him. He was pointing at buildings, and a lot of the buildings have the historical dates of creation on them, you know, and there are numbers like 1407, and he would look at us and say, "So, what was your country doing in 1407?"
Yeah, we're falling over it over here. You can't move for history,
right? Right.
You trip over, and oh, it's another Roman coin. What's this? I'll throw it on the pile with the others.
You know, in talking about math for children, the audience has heard this before, but I wanted to tell you about a horrific thing that happened to me in 1965. The United States embarked on what they called New Math. Have you ever heard of that?
I have heard of New Math via Tom Lehrer.
Oh, well.
Do you know Tom Lehrer?
I don't think so.
Okay, well, we'll get onto Tom Lehrer. That we'll write that down. We'll come back to that.
Okay,
I have heard of the New Math via someone else, but go ahead.
It was this horrible, horrible idea they had. Conceptually, as an engineer, one of the things we learn is that it's better to be able to figure something out than to memorize it. Because if yes. you figure it out, then you can always get to it. You don't have to, you know, count on your memory. But they took that and they applied that to the idea of addition and subtraction.
Yes.
And they told us that it was unimportant to memorize your math tables. And mm-hmm. they said, as long as you can figure it out with using fives and tens, you're okay. So they taught us things that added to five and things that added to 10. And so they said, okay, if you're going to add 8 and 5, you don't need to memorize that and know that it's 13, because you know that 5 is 2 plus 3, 2 plus 8 is 10, plus 3 is 13. So every single time I have to add 8 and 5, I have to do that in my head. It's as though they taught me to read phonetically and then never allowed me to memorize any of the words. So I'm crippled. I took 2 years of calculus and got straight A's in it in college. And, you know, I mean, physics, the whole thing, I've got this going on, and I am paralyzed when I'm faced with addition or subtraction.
I can understand this person I mentioned, Tom Lehrer. He was a mathematician. He used to lecture at Harvard, and he was a moonlighting mathematician, as I like to call him, because in his spare time, he was actually a satirical comedy song writer. And he's one of the best satirical songwriters there's ever been. Incredible. You haven't heard of him. Go find his stuff, Tom Lehrer. And he wrote a song about the new math. Partly because he was interested in it, because he was a mathematician. Mm-hmm. And he described it just like you said. You can't take 3 from 2, 2 is less than 3. So you look at the 4 in the 10 space, then that's really 4 tens. So you make it 3 tens, regroup, and you change the 10 to 10 ones, and you add them 2, make 12. Take away 3, that's 9. Okay?
Exactly.
That's how the song goes.
Oh, I looked it up in Wikipedia a while ago, and I just laughed because it was from 1965 to halfway through 1966. Mm-hmm. It's like, they went, oh man, that was really stupid. So if you happen to be in, you know, seventh grade in that year, you're screwed. You got no chance.
Yes, I can imagine.
So let's go back to some of the things I read in your bio. I understand you have a lot of circus skills. Where did that come from?
Because I've got no talent for anything useful. mathematics and juggling. A lot of jugglers tend to be mathematicians. I think it attracts a certain sort of person. It's not so much a team sport, juggling, although it can be. But you go away and you work out how to do it, and then you come back and you can socialise then. But you have to go away and learn how to do it. So I guess that it's kind of attracts the same sort of person that would be attracted to mathematics. You have to go away and go into some sort of internal world and work it out and then come back. So juggling tends to attract the mathematicians, the computer scientists, and on the other end of the spectrum, the alternative lifestyle people, the hippies, the grungy people. So it's interesting to go to something like a juggling convention. They have juggling conventions, who knew? And half the people will be these geeky physicists, computer scientists sort of people. And the other half are the people with handles, wearing shoes at all, dreadlocks.
So it's two ends of the spectrum there?
Two ends of the spectrum, and this is where we meet.
Well, no, I found you. I'm not actually sure where I found the link, but just stumbled across Singing Banana in YouTube. And you had a fabulous video where you explained how to figure out the correct, the shortest distance between four towns, but you did it using bubbles. And I've watched this video over and over and again, and there's so many things I like about it. I like that you explain the math. I like that it's an interesting problem. I like your enthusiasm more than, I mean, that really, really is what hooks you. But even down to your production quality of the care you take in wiping the bubbles off the front face of the plastic, of the glass, and how you, you're always right on with the camera and you hold it for the right length of time. I mean, it's not like it's a professionally created, you know, big studio effort, but you do every single thing right in that, I think.
Well, bless your heart. They're homemade. They are amateur. It's just, I have a camera. When I started making these YouTube things, I did decide at some point that I'd get a fairly decent home camera, but it's not. It's a £500 camera, mm-hmm. whatever that is in dollars. But it's not a professional camera. Anything that those things that you said are things that I've learned through constantly. I mean, I tour, I give live talks, I make these videos. I made lots of videos that weren't good enough, that made mistakes. It's just constant practice.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Well, so to talk a little bit about, you've got those videos, and then in the show notes, you started talking about working with iTunes U.
Yeah, yeah. So I have my YouTube channel. So I started off, like any old YouTube user, you know, I put up a video there to entertain my friends, to share something. I put up a maths video there so that I could explain something to my maths friends, my maths colleagues, about something I was talking about. And then I just started doing a few more of those, really as an excuse to practice as well. I mean, I talked about practicing, and it was an excuse to practice. And I just ended up keeping that up and keeping going. And I try and make one a week-ish, you know, or when I can. And it tends to be, I have no plan. It just tends to be the thing I'm most interested in talking about that week, whatever's on my mind. And then I do it. I've started putting them on iTunes. This is a new thing to me. Mm. So iTunes, I've... For a start, I avoid using. I don't actually like the program. I don't know about you.
I think I'm one of three people on Earth who does like it, but it's been on my nerves lately. It's been erasing podcasts on me, but anyway.
Yeah, it's massive, it's something I've not wanted to have, so I've not been using it. But then I bought an iPhone and then, you know, marvelous things, these iPhones, but you have to have the iTunes, which I resent. So you have to have the iTunes. And so I could see, So I started to learn how it works. So you got music and films on there. That's actually quite good. And then I started talking to one of my colleagues at the university, at Cambridge University, where I work. And he's the communications officer. He's in charge of all of Cambridge University's websites and public communication things. So he's in charge of their iTunes channel. And he said, I've seen your YouTube stuff, James. You should have it on our iTunes channel. And I said, yes. And that's that story. And so now I am under the Cambridge University banner on iTunes. It's the same videos I do on YouTube, but
so you didn't get all stodgy and official and boring.
Well, there will be there are those sort of people around in Cambridge, stuffy people, And when they see what I'm doing, they may bust a cummerbund and pop a monocle. So I'll get away with it for as long as I can. We've renamed it on YouTube. It's called Singing Banana. Of course it is. What else would it be? Singing Banana on YouTube. On iTunes, it's called Quite Easily Done, QED.
You know, my husband, when he saw your in the show notes that you had spelled that out, he started to mock you for spelling it out. But before he could get the words out, I said, "Is that what QED stands for?" And he said, "Okay, I guess I can't mock him then." I've used QED as long as I can remember.
No, it's not what it stands for, you see. It's a little maths humor on my part.
Oh, it doesn't stand for that?
No, it's Latin. Now, I'm going to get this wrong. It's something like quad erest demonstratum, as was to be shown.
Okay, that's what I thought. Okay, now I get to mock him. That'll be even more fun. That's right, which was to be demonstrated.
Yes, as was to be demonstrated.
That's what you write at the end of a proof.
Yeah. So a little joke on my part. Quite easily done. I spent ages thinking of that title. What are we going to call it? I'm not allowed to call it Singing Banana. We guessed I wouldn't be allowed to call it Singing Banana.
Might as well not start there.
So that was ages I spent thinking of that.
Oh, that's funny. Now I'm wondering where he had heard that. Has anybody ever called it that?
Yes. I'm not the first.
Okay. That is really, really funny. I enjoy that. So you're doing it through iTunes U. I've been really intrigued with iTunes U since my buddy Ron was driving between two buildings a couple times a day to do work. He had offices in both buildings. And the buildings were maybe three quarters of a mile apart. So it was taking him 15 minutes to drive and park. And then one day he got a better idea. He went on to iTunes U and he started downloading lectures and he put them on his iPod and he started walking. And he got there in 12 minutes instead of 15 minutes. He got exercise, lost a little weight, and got smarter. It's like,
brilliant.
Yeah, it was just awesome. So that was actually the first time I'd heard of iTunes U. He was taking a physics class or something.
Well, like I said, it's new to me. It's fairly new to me as well. And it doesn't seem to be getting used as much as it could do. It's nowhere near the popularity of YouTube or anything like that. And it would be nice for people to check it out, iTunes U. It's part of the iTunes. Lectures by academics, lecturers from universities on all sorts of topics. I'm thrilled because I put my things on there and it went to number one.
Oh, wow.
On the mathematical category on that list. And on iTunes overall, it was like number 12.
Wow. Oh, that's fantastic.
I was thrilled. But however, I'll confess, this is actually only based on a few hundred views. So we need more of this. And I watch it. It goes up and down. I watch it yo-yo up and down these lists. It changes every day.
Now, I noticed I went out there and I did put the link to iTunes U in the show notes so people can go over and subscribe and write comments and that sort of thing. I did notice there weren't any comments, so of course I put one in to start it off. I've been told that comments have an effect on how highly ranked you are and the rate of increase in subscribers. So just, you know, having 10,000 subscribers is good, but having it go from 8 to 10 you know, overnight would actually rise you faster in the ranking. So it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy because once you get up high, then you stay high because you're getting more visibility.
Of a very, very possible, very likely, yeah.
And the comments, you might see comments that I won't see because podcasts don't, you don't see the comments in the different countries, I think.
Oh,
so you might see comments in Britain, but you might not be able to see my comment here. I think that's usually true.
How interesting, because I think I do have comments, and I don't think they're from you.
Right. So I just did it earlier this morning. So if anybody does go out there and watch it, go ahead and put comments. And as I tell them when I ask for comments on my show, is you don't have to say something nice. It's just comments that actually help.
but in my case, yes, they do.
Oh, okay. They do need to be nice?
Yeah, they do.
Okay. Oh, I love that. I love that. Hey, let's see. There was... I wanted to ask you about something. With your love of math, have you ever seen the hardest, easiest geometry problem?
No. I hesitate to ask. What is that?
It's the most lovely thing. I'll put a link in the show notes again, and I'll send it to you. It's a very, very simple problem. It's a triangle, an equilateral triangle with... an isosceles triangle. Mm-hmm. It has a line going from the bottom left corner up and intersecting the right side, and another line from the bottom right corner intersecting the left side. Mm-hmm. You know the angles of those two lines, and then where they intersect on the two sides, there's a line drawn between those, and the question is, what is the angle between that diagonal and the diagonal down to the bottom left? Kind of hard to do in your head probably, but it's one of those things where you'd go, I'm just going to do, you know, complementary angles and add to 180 and I'm going to blah, 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 and I'm going to know the answer. And it doesn't work. No matter what you do, you just end up proving that 180 equals 180.
Which is true, by the way.
As it turns out. The guy that posted it said he's gotten, thousands of people have written to him with the answer, and about maybe 5% of the people who've answered it have been right. And he says if he doesn't do it for a couple of years, he can't remember how to do it either. It takes him like 2 hours. I have worked on this for 4 months now, and on and off, I carry it around with me in my purse, and I can't figure it out yet. It's wonderful. It's just so happy making.
You'll have to post that.
I'm not sure everybody would enjoy it as much as I do, but I just love it. I think it's a lot of fun.
I'll take a look.
Ooh. So let's see. Is there anything else you want to tell people about what you're doing? And I would love to have you back on the show anytime you want to talk about math. This is fun for me. This is candy.
Fantastic. I'd love to. I just want to say thank you for having me on.
Oh, well, definitely enjoyed it. I put links to Jim's bio so you can see how he got where he is at enigma.maths.org. I put a link to his YouTube and Twitter and all that at singingbanana.com. And in particular, the bubble solution on connecting the towns in YouTube that I particularly liked. And then you'll get suckered into watching all of them.
Yes, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I had such a great time with Jim. After we got off the air, we just kept talking for about another half hour. I hope we can get him back on the show again sometime. Just love his infectious enthusiasm for math. It's just really, really cool to hear. Well, I'm afraid that brings us to a close for today. It's always sad to see the show end. But no fear, we will be back again next week with more fun. Many thanks to our sponsors for helping make all of this possible, ScreenSteps from ScreenSteps.com and Smile from SmileSoftware.com. Don't forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing me at Allison@podfeet.com. Follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Now, I contribute a fair amount over on Google+ nowadays, so just search for me by name if you want to circle me up over there. If you want to join in the fun of the live show, and I highly recommend it, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic Nocilla Castaways. You can also go over to justin.tv and do a search for NocillaCast and find the recorded live shows, which sounds like an oxymoron, but you get what I mean. So you can go back and you can actually read the live chat and what kind of silliness people were talking about. This week, people were actually quite serious. We were discussing our slide rules and early RPN calculators. So anyway, it's a lot of fun to join live, but if you can't, it's kind of fun to go see the recorded episodes as well. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.